Everybody ready to go?
All right, if you'd call the next case, please.
The court will now call in the matter of the guardianship of Francis Phillips, an alleged incapacitated person, and in the matter of guardianship of Edwin Woolley, an alleged incapacitated person. May it please the court, Ms. Erica Kane will argue for the appellant, Texas Department of Aging and Disability Service. Mr. Mike Windsor will argue for Corey Nelson, guardian ad litem for George Francis Phillips, and Mr. Terry Hammond will argue for the amicus curiae for 214-291 CV.
All right, Erica, you ready?
Good afternoon, and may it please the court. I'm here on behalf of the Department of Aging and Disability Services asking that the court reverse the two orders denying the department's pleas to the jurisdiction in both matters below. The reason we are asking for the court to do this is that Section 161-101 of the Texas Human Resources Code makes absolutely clear in plain language that DADS, the department, may only be appointed a permanent guardian under two circumstances. One, when DADS itself files an application to be a permanent guardian, or two, if DADS otherwise agrees to be permanent guardian. Neither of those circumstances occurred in neither of the cases at issue here. For that reason, the probate court had no jurisdiction and no statutory authority to appoint DADS a permanent guardian, such that DADS should be dismissed from this case to the extent an application for permanent guardianship has been filed in both cases. The language that controls the result of this case is found in subsection D of 161-101 of the Texas Human Resources Code. That section could not be clearer. It provides that, quote, the department may not be required by a court to file an application for guardianship, permanent guardianship. And it further says that DADS may not be appointed as a permanent guardian for any individual unless the department files an application to serve or otherwise agrees to serve as the individual's guardian of the person or state or both. Here, the appellee in neither case disputed that neither of these two prerequisites occurred in this case. In addition to that, DADS is a state entity that has sovereign immunity from suit, and at no point has any party cited any statute or any authority that would have allowed the probate court below to appoint DADS as permanent guardian in the absence of a waiver of immunity. Nevertheless, the appellee and the amicus here make two arguments in an attempt to overcome this clear statutory language. The appellee focuses on a separation of powers argument, arguing that 161-101 is unconstitutional because it divests the probate court of some jurisdictional authority to appoint who it wishes as a guardian. The reason this argument fails as a legal matter is because it is well settled that a probate court is a court of limited jurisdiction, and it derives its jurisdiction not from the Constitution, but solely by statutes enacted by the legislature. Here, there is simply an absence of any statutory authority that would allow the probate court to appoint DADS as a permanent guardian over its objection.
And you said something back there that I'm having trouble with. Waiver of immunity? That's the waiver of immunity from suit. Are you saying that by appointing your folks, you were sued by the probate court?
So, Your Honor, to the extent imposing an order on a state entity would seek to essentially encroach upon the state's immunity from both suit and liability, there has to be some sort of waiver of that immunity. And here, there's simply no statute that waives the DADS immunity from an order that would impose upon it an obligation here to serve as a guardian. And the only statutory authority that does exist actually states the opposite, that DADS itself has to essentially volunteer itself in to serve as a guardian in order for the probate court to have authority to issue an order imposing that obligation on DADS. Because any time a state entity is brought into court, essentially against its agreement, which is what is occurring here, DADS never has agreed to serve as a permanent guardian. There has to be some articulated waiver of the state entity's immunity to impose an obligation, for the court to impose some sort of obligation on the entity. And here there simply doesn't exist any such authority.
What's your best case authority for that position? Because I didn't see any, period.
Well, I think, Your Honor, so we have Wichita State Hospital, which we cite in our reply brief, which just talks about generally there has to be a statutory waiver of immunity. We have City of El Paso versus Heinrich that talks about when you want to impose an obligation on the state, that the party who seeks to do that has to show, because the state has immunity, first of all, you can't sue an entity straight out like they're trying to do here by suing dads directly. You have to, in order to impose essentially an injunction, which this would be, on a state entity, you have to sue an official in their official capacity. That's City of El Paso.
Suing dads directly.
Well, again, by filing the application for the appointment of permanent guardian and seeking to appoint dads, they're essentially asking the court below, the probate court, to issue an order imposing an obligation on a state entity, dads. And so we're not on the opposite side of the V, if you will, like we would be in a normal case. This was an application seeking to invoke the jurisdiction of the court to issue an order against a state entity that would have imposed obligations on the state entity.
And you had to be served with citation and be commanded to appear and answer.
Yes.
So that, in the estates code provision, would make you a party, because those who are commanded by citation to appear and answer are parties to the lawsuit, are they not?
Yes. I don't think there can be any dispute that we have been called upon to be a party to this suit, and the end result that the appellee or the persons who filed the application seek in this case is an order imposing obligations on dads to serve as permanent guardian in both of these instances. And so the principles, there's essentially no authority that would say that the principles of sovereign immunity shouldn't apply. They apply as a default, and then there has to be some sort of statutory waiver that would then allow the court to overcome that default immunity. And it simply doesn't exist here. And in fact, as we point out, that you begin with the proposition that a probate court is only going to have the authority that's granted to it by statute, period. And here, the probate court has never been granted authority to impose any kind of order of permanent guardianship on dads, absent dads' express agreement or dads filing the application itself. And 161-101D makes that absolutely clear. And so whether the court simply goes under the principles of limited jurisdiction of the probate court and looks purely at the language of the statute, or looks at this from a sovereign immunity standpoint, the result is the same. And that is that the court below has no authority, period, to issue an order against dads imposing a permanent guardianship obligation on it in either of the cases here, because the necessary statutory prerequisites to have that happen have not occurred in either suit, and the parties can point to nothing that would show that those obligations, that those prerequisites have occurred. And for that reason, the court simply need look no further than the plain language of 161-101D to resolve this suit. And I think the appellees recognize this, because instead of trying to counter an argument and saying that the prerequisites were satisfied, they instead attempt to argue that the statute is unconstitutional. And again, because there's no constitutionally derived powers possessed by a probate court, because they are courts created by the legislature here was able to then confine its authority confine the probate court's authority to situations where dads has either applied as a permanent guardian or is agreeing to serve as a permanent guardian, and has limited the probate court's jurisdiction to only those situations to allow it to then appoint dads as permanent guardian. When neither of those situations is present, the probate court has no statutory authority. And in this case, because the probate court is essentially ignoring that plain language and is attempting to appoint dads as a guardian by an application filed by the probate court's investigator. And the statute, 161-101, does not allow dads to be appointed permanent guardian when somebody else other than dads has applied for the guardianship. And that in and of itself, which is plainly apparent in the record, should end this case and result in the dismissal of dads from the suit seeking the appointment of the permanent guardianship. Now, I will point out that I think the parties make a, on the other side, make an argument that, well, if Dad's isn't appointed as guardian, then who you know, there's nobody left here to appoint as guardian. And there's a belief that from the, at least the investigator who filed the application, that a guardianship should be set up in both of these cases. Now, the statute that exists here only applies to dads. The probate court below has authority generally to hear the application for guardianship filed by any person, including its own investigator, and it can appoint a person it deems proper as a permanent guardian. So in this case, while the court has no authority to appoint dads as a permanent guardian, it could certainly appoint another individual, a family member, a professional guardianship program, as a permanent guardian in this case, or in both cases, if it deems appropriate. Where the court ran afoul of the law is in seeking to hear the applications seeking to appoint dads in a manner that was contrary to the only authority it has to appoint dads, and that is in 161-101. Now, I do also want to say that the parties on the other side make the argument that, well, dads in this case agreed to be a temporary guardian, so shouldn't that then allow dads to serve as a permanent guardian in this case? Isn't that some sort of agreement on dads' part to act as permanent guardian under the language of 161-101? And there's simply no authority to support that proposition. The way that this procedure works is that dads, in terms of the estates code, can be appointed, and the statutes do allow a probate court to appoint dads as a temporary guardian, quote, of last resort. So there is some statutory authority that the probate court has to appoint dads as a temporary guardian. And pursuant to that authority, dads agreed to serve as a temporary guardian in this case. That authority simply doesn't exist with respect to permanent guardianships. There also, I think, is important to know for context, some authority to allow probate courts to appoint dads as a successor guardian. And I think the important thing to realize here is that in those two circumstances, there are necessary limits on essentially the drain of resources that would occur by appointing dads as a guardian. And because the temporary guardianship is limited, obviously, in duration. Statutorily, it's limited to 60 days unless there is a contest which can extend it. And a successor guardianship is limited by statute in the sense that dads can only be appointed in a maximum of 55 cases statewide as successor guardian. So what the legislature has done is, in limited circumstances, has said that the probate court does have authority to appoint dads as guardian in certain circumstances, but then it has placed limits on the drain on resources that would occur in the temporary and successor guardianship context. That doesn't exist here with respect to the permanent guardianship statute. Rather, instead, what the legislature has done is said that dads itself will make the decision as to when or whether or not it will serve as a permanent guardian. And so what we have here from the appellee and the amicus is essentially a policy argument disagreeing with what the legislature has enacted with respect to the probate court's authority, or its very limited authority, to appoint dads as a permanent guardian. That is an argument that needs to be made to the legislature, not the probate court and not this court, because again, the legislature gets to decide what authority it wishes to confer on the probate court. And it has been made expressly clear by the legislature through 161-101D that it's dad's decision as to whether or not to agree to serve as a permanent guardian. Because that has occurred in neither one of these cases, the probate court lacks jurisdiction, lacks authority to appoint dads in either case. And so we ask that the court dismiss both applications in this case that seek to appoint dads over its objection. And unless the court has any questions, I will see the rest of my time. Thank you.
Mike, which one of you is up next?
I am not.
Okay.
It plays the court. The facts of these cases, I mean, there are two cases. The Phillips case, the facts are probably not as well developed as in the Woolley case, but they share some commonality. There were investigators that went out, said both of these people could not continue living where they were living, that they were a danger to themselves, that they could not care for themselves, they could not make those decisions. And in both cases, they did not have anyone else to act as a guardian for them. There was no natural person to step up and do the job. The facts in the Woolley case, as I said, are probably a little bit better developed. And here's where the, I don't know what to call it, a conundrum comes in as far as dads is concerned. In the Woolley case, the Adult Protective Services goes out there, does an investigation. The proposed ward has dementia. He's living in squalor in a mobile home. He cannot pass the five item memory test. He scores 0 for 5. But he has some money. He's got about $400 cash, and he gets about $700 a month, I believe, from Social Security or disability, which is not enough to pay for a facility, but maybe it's enough to make him more of a danger to himself, because now he's got some walking around money or some cab money. And his proposal for who to take care of himself was his daughter, who had not lived with him since she was 2 and had no relationship and did not want the job, and his brother, who had not seen him in many years, was estranged and did not want the job. Under the temporary guardianship, he was taken to a care facility, nursing home, if you will, where they were to provide care for him. But actually, in this case, the day before the hearing, all of the emergency temporary guardianships and extensions had passed. So, and he was still there of his own accord. He had not left. There was nobody that legally had the authority to keep him there. So this becomes important. He could just walk out on the street, go back to the same place he was there, if he could make his way back to his mobile home, and start the cycle all over again. There were a number of people who came in and testified that was not an acceptable situation. When Judge Virchel asked Dad's attorney, what's Dad's position on this? Dad's came back with, well, we believe that there is a lesser alternative to a guardianship available. Virchel asked, well, what would that be? How is that possible here under these circumstances? Well, he's in a nursing home right this minute. Now, in my brief, Dad's, in their reply, took some umbrage to my saying that seemed like a bit of a cavalier attitude, to where, well, he's okay right now because right this flaming second, he's in a nursing home. It's almost akin to, well, I don't have to tell my kid to get out of the street because there's no car coming right now. And apparently this, and there was questioning by the judge on this, that this would just circle around endlessly. Well, okay, if we say he's okay now and doesn't need a guardian, couldn't he go back to where he was and this process would start all over again? You'd be making the same argument some amount of time down the line. Well, yes, but that doesn't matter. That is Dad's best explanation in either case for why they believe that there was an alternative to a guardianship, which is the determination that they make under the statute, under the Human Resources Code. And I guess my part of this argument is more the constitutional issue. What we've got here is we've got competing statutes that use almost identical language, not quite, but almost identical language, and give two different groups, I guess if you will, two different branches of government the authority to make this determination. On the one hand, dads, as a part of their statutory scheme, is charged with determining whether there is a less restrictive alternative to a guardianship available. If there is, then they opt out of the case of their own volition. It's now the estates code, shows how in tune I am, I guess. The estates code has the exact same provision for the court investigator. Each of the statutory probate courts have an investigator. It's an arm of the court to make that determination. Is there a lesser alternative to a guardianship available? So as a prerequisite to the court doing its action, the investigator has to say, no, there is no lesser alternative. And in these two cases, what we have is dad saying there is, the court investigator saying there's not. I mean, literally, the court investigator is an arm of the court. So the court says one thing, dad says another.
That's really getting into the merits of the case, isn't it? And really, the only issue before this court on appeal is the plea to the jurisdiction and their position that they're entitled to immunity. It's not even the constitutional issue. We're not ever going to get to that, are we?
Well, I believe that their claim of immunity, all of this boils forth from their determination that they have to make that there is no, that there is an alternative. If that fails, if that part of the statute is unconstitutional because of the separation of powers clause, then I think the whole rest of this scheme relies on that of dad's doing this, dad's doing that.
Well, we can't review the court's finding that this statute's unconstitutional because he didn't reduce that finding to writing. We can't review that. We're not, is it your position that in our opinion we're going to say he was right or he was wrong? It is unconstitutional or it's not?
I think that dad's whole argument hinges on the constitutionality of that statute. Now, to step back, I mean, dad's has the burden in this case of showing that their plea to the jurisdiction ought to have occurred. And as a threshold matter, you don't usually see a plea to the jurisdiction sort of coming to fruition in the middle of a case. It's a beginning of the case sort of thing where I raise my plea to the jurisdiction. It seems that rather than a plea to the jurisdiction, what dad's is really complaining is the judge did something he shouldn't have done. This ought to just be a regular old appeal rather than an interlocutory appeal or any kind of plea to the jurisdiction. That their argument is couched in terms of plea to the jurisdiction. That's how they get here with an interlocutory appeal because they're the state agency. I think anybody else would just be saying, you know, the trial court overstepped its bounds, as it were. I think Mr. Hammond is going to address some of the statutory scheme issues in a much better way, much more elegantly than I could ever do it, because he's familiar with it and the guardianship and a state's bar in a much better way than I ever could hope to do this. It is worth noting one of the arguments that Dad's has brought up is that they only get 55 state cases a year and that this is a public policy issue. They did not raise the 55 case limit as a part of their basis for not accepting either of these cases before the trial court. It's out there, that's true, that's what the statute says, but they didn't invoke that here. They just came into court and said, we're dads, we've decided that there is another alternative to a guardianship available. You cannot appoint us as permanent guardian. Thank you very much. We're done. And by the way, if you don't do that, we've got some sort of plea to the jurisdiction argument, which I just, it seems to me that that's not the right type of whether they should be able to make it or not, that's not the right type of argument here. What they're really complaining is that the trial judge did something he wasn't supposed to be doing. So, unless there are any more questions, I will give my time to Mr. Hammond. Thank you.
Terry?
May it please the court, Terry Hammond, amicus curiae. I first of all would like to thank the court for accepting my brief and also for allowing me to speak before you today. I'm not an appellate lawyer. I'm a guardianship attorney. I briefed at the Third Court of Appeals 25 years ago and have been in a Court of Appeals maybe twice since then, have never argued. So I appreciate you allowing me to come with you today and spend this time with you. I would first of all like to remember a very important doctrine that has threaded through judicial systems for millennia, and that is the parens patriae doctrine. Black's Law Dictionary, 6th edition, refers to it as, or defines it as, parent of the country, the role of the state, formerly the king, formerly the Caesar, as sovereign and guardian of persons under legal disability. It is the principle that the state must care for those who cannot care for themselves. The state must protect the health, comfort, and welfare of the people. So what we really have here today, and one of the reasons I'm interested as an amicus here, is these issues that are before the court today will affect, your decision will affect, literally millions of elderly and disabled Texans in this state. I could go into some statistics here. I'll just say that now there are several million Texans with disabilities. 15% of our population are Texans with disabilities. By 2014, 16% of our population will be elderly, 7 million Texans. At this time, DADS has 1,200 people, or at least the last statistic I saw, DADS had 1,200 people under guardianship in their program. And really the key question here is who gets in and who does not to the state guardianship program. Francis Phillips did not get in, and you have before you the record of what happened here. I read over the transcripts, and honestly, they were painful for me to read. Judge Furchill, Patrick Furchill, has been on the bench here some 30 years as a probate judge. He's very well respected, not only statewide, but nationally. I want to make the point that this is not just a statutory probate court issue. All 254 counties in this state have somebody adjudicating guardianship cases. These DADS issues are coming up before judges all over the state. That includes constitutional county judges, not just statutory probate courts. So I disagree with the idea that this is solely a creature of statute. We have hundreds of years of jurisprudence that impact upon the well-being of people with disabilities and with diminished capacity. Just a word about Francis Phillips. I want us to remember that this is about a person, and it's about a woman who...
But we're stuck with the statute, the way it's written, and your time is limited, and we'd like to hear about the statute, please.
Okay. There are several statutory schemes. There's a Texas Estates Code scheme. There's a human resources scheme, and actually two. Adult Protective Services is charged with investigating abuse, neglect, and exploitation. About 10 years ago, through a statutory reform, guardianship was taken out of APS and put over with DADS. That's why DADS has a guardianship program now. The reason why is so APS would do the investigations, DADS would do the guardianships. As you heard, there are multiple investigations going on by the court investigator, APS, and by DADS. In this case, Your Honor, five different investigations revealed there was no alternative to guardianship. You had the court investigator, you had a guardian ad litem, you had an attorney ad litem, you had the judge himself, and you had DADS all coming in and Adult Protective Services. Everybody agreed Ms. Phillips had diminished capacity and needed a guardian. DADS served as temporary guardian. They accepted appointment. So in my view, DADS submitted itself to the jurisdiction of the court. And I think the questions that were asked early on about immunity from suit, immunity from damages, we cite cases where a action to determine a person's rights is different from cases where sovereign immunity would apply. So it would be my position, sovereign immunity does not apply here. This was not a lawsuit against the state. It was an application for guardianship, temporary and permanent. That's all that it was. So we do not believe that the state can avoid involvement in this proceeding as a result of sovereign immunity. Secondly, with regard to this Chapter 161 of the Human Resources Code, Adult Protective Services referred this case to DADS for guardianship. The court did its own investigation and referred it to DADS for guardianship as well. Everybody involved agreed that Ms. Phillips needed a guardian. We make arguments in the amicus brief that there is a way to resolve these issues without going to the constitutionality arguments. And that comes down to judicial review. Does Judge Fertchel have the authority as a judge under the Texas Estates Code to review the investigations that were done in the interest of Ms. Phillips, by the court investigator, by Adult Protective Services, and by DADS? If I can just briefly cite to the record, I'm looking at the appellate's brief, actually, page 6, where there's a footnote where it says Ms. Phillips did not have the ability to leave her nursing facility placement, nor did her family take steps to remove her from the facility. This is what DADS defines as a less restrictive alternative to guardianship. You put the person in a nursing home, you close your file, say to the judge, you can't appoint us, you can't even review what we did, and that's exactly what DADS did here. They said to Judge Fertchel, we're not going to put on any evidence. You don't have the right to question us about our investigation, about our findings, about our determinations. If you look at the record, Judge Fertchel says, how can that be? I'm a probate judge. I'm charged with looking after the interest of Ms. Phillips. I have to be able to review what you did. Did you do a thorough investigation? In fact, Judge Fertchel pleads with the DADS attorney and says, I've got the transcript here. Mr. Love says, the DADS attorney says to the court, we've never been asked to serve as the guardian in this case. You just filed an application telling us we had to serve. So Judge Fertchel says, well, this is on page 16 of the transcript. Well, if we're going to spend all this money and have all this time, Mr. Love, will Dad serve as permanent guardian of Ms. Phillips? And Mr. Love responds, Your Honor, that's not properly before me at this time. This is completely backwards from the way it should be. It is Judge Fertchel who is reviewing the actions of everyone involved with Judge Phillips, with Ms. Phillips. But what you see in the transcript and in the brief is that DADS is saying to Judge Fertchel, you cannot question us, you cannot put us on the stand, you have no jurisdiction over us whatsoever. And Judge Fertchel says, well, that can't be. To the extent that you're relying on 161 of the Human Resources Code, I find that unconstitutional because I'm a judge and I have a right to review what you do. There are a number of other things in the brief that touch on separation of powers and judicial review. I'll certainly defer to the court on those issues, and in the time that I have left, answer any questions that you might have of me.
Can't these two statutes be read in harmony? In other words, the court investigator makes a determination, and then DADS makes a determination. And DADS may disagree with what the court investigator said. In fact, that's what's happened here. But when DADS disagrees, it just means that they can't be forced to be guardian in that circumstance. And isn't that harmonious between the two statutes?
Well, there's actually three statutes, Your Honor. The third is Chapter 48 of the Human Resources Code, which charges APS with doing a thorough investigation and referring for guardianship. So you've got, again, these three thorough investigations going.
It doesn't say that the court is bound by DADS determination. It just says that if DADS says we don't agree, that the court can't force them to be the guardian.
Yes, Your Honor. I think where Judge Fertchel raised his issue, though, and this is the point to make here, is the judge said, I have to be able to review the investigation that you did to see if you did a thorough investigation, to see if this is truly a less restrictive alternative. Clearly, Judge Fertchel did not believe this to be a less restrictive alternative to guardianship.
But I guess what I'm saying is, even if DADS does the investigation and they're wrong in their conclusion, all that means is that the judge can still appoint a guardian, they just can't appoint DADS.
It is our position, Your Honor, that subsection D that DADS relies on here has to be read in conjunction with B and C. If you just look at subsection D without the others, we do believe that there's a constitutionality argument. If you look at them all together, then the judge, the court, should have a role in reviewing what was done under B and C before you ever even get to D. DADS put its foot down and said, Judge, we're not going to put on our caseworker. We're not going to respond to you. You have no jurisdiction over us. And that's when Judge Fertchel said that can't be. So we believe that you have to look at the entire statute as a whole. If you just apply D without B and C, it's an improper application of the statute, and that's what DADS is asking for here.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
I would just like to make a few points during my rebuttal time. I think that Justice Sudarth is correct that we have essentially different entities making different determinations. The result here is if DADS makes its determination, the court disagrees with it, the solution is that the investigator can pursue an application for guardianship, but just can't name DADS. And that is where the conflict occurred here. And I think to assist the court maybe with this issue of sovereign immunity in this somewhat odd context, because it usually doesn't come up in this kind of context. This court issued an opinion in December in the case State versus Valerie Saxian, and there's no Southwest 3rd site yet, but it's 02-13-227 CV out of this court. And that was a case that, you know, when you talk about, well, haven't you submitted to the jurisdiction because you were a temporary guardian? Well, that was a case in which the state had actually sued Ms. Saxian, and then she tried to cross-claim against the state. This court looked at those claims, applied the default principle of sovereign immunity, because anytime somebody tries to sue the state, and regardless of the context, state's going to start off with sovereign immunity, and determined that her cross-claims were barred by sovereign immunity. In doing so, this court cited a number of recent authorities on the issue of sovereign immunity, and one of the authorities it pointed out was a case from Austin, the Austin Court of Appeals, called Creedmoor-Maha Water Supply. And that case basically says that even in suits for injunctive relief, where you're trying to order, not damages, but you're trying to order the state to do something, if what you're trying to do is get the state to essentially do something that they have the discretion, they've been conferred discretion to, over the matter, then sovereign immunity bars that claim, because the courts cannot come in and essentially second guess something that has been conferred to the discretion of the state. And that's precisely what 161.101 does. If you look at 161.101 sub C, it specifically says that the less restrictive alternative determination is if the department determines there's no less restrictive or there is a less restrictive alternative. So the statute is completely written in terms of the department and nobody else, not the court, not anybody else, making the determination. And so when you have a situation like that where the statute has conferred the discretion completely to the relevant state agency, sovereign immunity will bar, even if an injunction is sought, regardless of the claim, it will bar that suit, because it is just a bedrock principle of sovereign immunity, as this court recently recognized in the Saxian case, that the state cannot be essentially coerced into taking a discretionary act. The courts cannot intrude into that discretionary act. And that's precisely what we have here. We understand that the appellee and amicus disagree with that policy decision in the statute, but that is the policy decision that the legislature has made, because the probate court acted contrary to that, and because the probate court had no jurisdiction to act contrary to that, we ask that the court reverse the denials of the plea of jurisdiction and dismiss the applications for permanent guardianship against DADS. Unless the court has any questions, thank you for your time.
Thank you. We appreciate your argument. We appreciate you coming all this way. There's just no easy way to get here from there. So thank you for coming here. And y'all came all the way up from Austin, which is a little bit easier, but harder to get away from Austin, I would think. So we do appreciate it. Your case is submitted.